What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to spend this hour showing you why what happened this week matters and how it can inspire us to make our world a little better next week. This morning, at least two activists have chained themselves to a Shell oil ship docked in the port of Bellingham. It's a support vessel for the rig that's in Elliott Bay preparing to drill in the Arctic. Also this week, five women of a certain age got arrested protesting near the rig. Members of the activist group, the Raging Grannies, sipped tea from porcelain cups as they sat in rocking chairs chained together. 92-year-old arrestee Shirley Morrison told me this was not her first Shell oil protest.
It was the week before. I was on a sailboat with kayaks and canoes and all the rest, protesting that awful monster of a rig. There wasn't any wind, of course, for a sailboat, so we used up Shell's oil on our...
You had to use your motor to get around.
We had to use our motor to get around, yeah. And for the last couple weeks, I've been trying to figure out good actions for trying to stop the workers from coming in to work on that rig, chaining our rocking chairs together. The police stayed around quite a while trying to decide what to do with these five little old ladies, but some of them were not very old. They're only in their 60s or their 70s, and to me that's practically the prime of life.
It's the prime of life, and those arrests made for such a striking photograph that even a Seattle police officer told the Seattle Times that it gave the grannies a visual victory. So I ask you, panel, who is winning the public opinion war over Arctic drilling? Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, who's winning the public opinion war now?
I think right now the protesters, clearly, at least in Seattle, and it's not too difficult of a war to win. People already oppose Arctic drilling here, I think, by a large measure.
Well, then what about outside Seattle? Because the world is watching, right? Or at least America.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a great sense of that. I'm not sure the grannies penetrated outside of Seattle. I don't know that that's an image that went around the
Washington
world.
Washington Post profiled the woman you just heard from. Yep.
Oh, really? Okay, I missed that. I was going to say, I think that the bigger kind of global or national attention moment will come when this rig tries to leave.
Right.
And if people try to block it, that will be a very striking image that will be hard to resist sharing.
Bill Finkbeiner is the former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. Bill, who do you think is winning the public opinion war? Because there was a backlash against the kayakers in plastic, petroleum-made kayaks. Who's winning the public opinion
debate? I think pretty much mostly across America, oil companies are always going to lose the public opinion war. But I think that in some ways, it doesn't matter so much because there's a larger battle going on, and that's being won by the American consumer and American voter. And they're saying two things. They're saying, one, I want cheap gas. And then they're also saying, and I don't want to go to war in the Middle East. And so if you take those two things, then your options are Keystone Pipeline, drilling in the Arctic, cutting down on our use of gas and fossil fuels, buying, you know, from the Middle East. And if you'd sort of put all those on the table, I think the one that's going to be the most politically feasible is going to be probably drilling in the Arctic, unfortunately.
Well, then aren't you really saying that the public opinion war is being won by Shell Oil, as expressed by President Obama, who said, go ahead and drill in the Arctic?
It's almost two different wars. The war that Obama's winning and I think done an incredible job of is for decades, presidents have talked about energy independence, for America, and we're getting it for the first time. I mean, it's really a huge change. The second war debate that's happening is the debate about global warming. And that's really, I think, the debate that's kind of happening here. But that debate to me is a demand side debate more than a supply side, because we're going to buy gas from someplace as long as people keep putting it in their cars. And whether that's, again, if it's going to be the Middle East, then we're going to fight wars for it. If it's going to be from Canada, then we're going to, you know, build the pipeline. And if it's going to be from, you know, the Arctic, then we're going to drill up there. But if people aren't going to stop putting so much gas in their cars, then we're going to get it from someplace.
Also with us today, covering the news at the CisForCrank.com, Erica C. Barnett. Erica, what's your take on all this?
Well, I actually agree that the protesters are winning this war. I also think that there's a possibility that they'll do more than symbolic damage to Shell, you know, if not this time, then in the future, because this has been such a pain for the port of Seattle, and it's been a terrible PR situation for them. And I think other ports are looking at us and saying, you know, is it really worth it to go through weeks or months of these protests and, you know, this terrible PR? And, you know, maybe we won't host a rig like Shell's rig here. And one of the explicit goals of the protesters, I think, is not just to raise awareness of the issue, but also to delay this rig from going out as much as possible by slowing down work. And the reason that's important is because the drilling season in the Arctic is very short in the summer. And so any amount of delay will delay, you know, the amount of drilling they're able to do or even whether they're able to drill.
And I want to come back to this idea that the Arctic is a demand-side solution. People like to talk about that a lot. But the Arctic, by Shell's own admission, in terms of producing any oil, is like a decade out, maybe two decades. And so by that point, if we're relying on oil in the Arctic, according to the study in the journal Nature, we are in big trouble in terms of climate change. If we have not changed course by the time the Arctic could produce oil that would go into our cars, then we are so far gone down the path of altering the climate in this planet, on this planet, that this demand-side solutions won't be the issue at that point.
Yeah, I mean, if you say it's just demand and it's just consumers' fault that that we constantly need this new supply of oil, and there's this, you know, endless hunger, I think that completely ignores the fact that we don't have other options. We don't have, you know, in cities, we don't have good transportation options that aren't sitting alone in a gas-powered car. In terms of, you know, of just technology, we don't have good alternatives for single, you know, person vehicles that are not operated by gas. So you can't say, I mean, it's similar to people criticizing the protesters for using kayaks that were made out of oil. Well, okay, there isn't really another option for them to use. So similarly, I think it's wrongheaded to say that it's consumers' fault for using gas. They don't have another choice.
Okay, we need to give the last word to Bill Finkbeiner and move on.
I think the other choice is gas tax. I mean, I think you make gas so expensive that people start using less of it, and then you take those revenues and you put it into other options. So I don't think it's bad that people protested. I think it's good because I think, Eli, I think you're right. It's, you know, we're pretty far down the climate change path. And I just think that as long as we focus on saying it's the oil company's fault, we're sort of avoiding what the real issue is, which I think is that it's consumer demand that's driving the exploration.
Again, five raging grannies were arrested in this week's protest at Terminal 5. Shell has said it could send that drilling rig up to the Chukchi Sea any time now. We'll see what happens when they try to do that. This morning, a couple of activists chained themselves to a Shell oil vessel in the port of Bellingham. There will be more protests in Seattle when it comes time for the Polar Pioneer to pull out. And finally, we asked who's winning the public opinion debate, and what I heard from the panel is protesters are winning. The question is how much that matters. Now, it is graduation season, and later this hour, my panel will deliver their advice to University of Washington graduates. What is your advice, listener? We're live tweeting this program, so go to Twitter right now. The handle is @KUOW. And give us your nutshell advice to graduates. We'll read on the air the advice that we deem worth reading on the air. That's a challenge. It's just going to take you a moment. Surely you have something to say to a bird who is just now leaving the nest. What would you have told yourself? What scares you that you want graduates to avoid? What do you want more of in the world that these young people can give if only you will tell them what to do on Twitter? @KUOW. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Back with the Week in Review in a moment. K KUOW's Week in Review. Welcome to Friday. I'm Bill Radke. We're covering the top stories this week, and Seattle officials said this week that the city cannot afford to build and run a high-speed broadband network. A public pipe would be a money loser, but why not subsidize it the way we subsidize roads and buses and electricity? Let's ask Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, who is on the Technology Committee. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation to join your show.
So high-speed internet is not just about watching Amy Schumer videos. This week,
One of my favorite comedians.
Okay, but there's even more to do than watch her leave your makeup on music video. This week, for example, Filipino Community Center board member Joaquin Wee told KUOW that immigrants and low-income people really need the net to send money back home, to learn job skills, to stay in touch with family overseas.
Access to high-speed internet, equitable access, is really key for lifting all communities out of poverty or advancing their status in their communities. And from what we see, we support a city-owned, city-operated internet as a utility in the same way that electricity is regulated by Seattle City Light.
So, Councilmember Licata, this would cost taxpayers an estimated $500 or $600 million. Why don't we spend that for universal broadband?
Well, that's the question before us. And first of all, I give the mayor credit for doing this study. This study is not going to be the final word. As you know, it's over 180 pages. But the comment that was just made is, in fact, supported in the study. It showed that 80% of the respondents indicated that internet is an essential service, much like bus service, public transportation, or water supply or electricity supply. And that 30% right now only consider it affordable. Now, the question you raise is, well, why not just subsidize it? There have been other cities. Chattanooga is probably the most well-known that's actually made a decision to build a municipally-owned utility. They made that decision in 2005, and they are now providing service that's about 100 times faster than what Comcast was doing before, and they're actually making a profit. However, they did receive a $100 million grant from the federal government. I think the challenge before us is something that I want to see reviewed. And actually, I've organized a brown bag lunch and panel discussion next Thursday at noon at City Hall, and I've invited in Christopher Mitchell, who's a director of the nonprofit Community Brown Bag Networks, and he's already testified before the Council's Energy Committee back on May 13th. And we're also inviting our own executive director, head of our IT, Michael Mattmiller, to be on this discussion. And it's basically what you just raised. It's like, what can we do as a city to create a accessible broadband network that's affordable to everyone?
But Councilmember Licata, we've been discussing this for years. We tried using a private partner. That didn't work. But Seattle has a history of subsidizing expensive things, parks, roads, buses, etc. We are a tech-dependent economy with shoddy internet service. Why doesn't this clear the bar for the city?
Well, for one thing, it's driven by the executive office. The prior mayor, Mike McGinn, was trying to work out arrangement with Gigabyte, and that fell through. And before him, even going far back as Paul Schell, they've discussed this. What there's been resistance within, I would say, the city bureaucracy, because they look at the question of the cost of fiber, and it's an immense cost. Although,
well, this is my question: why don't we subsidize an admittedly immense cost?
We are doing that with our roads. $900 million is what the mayor is proposing.
Yes.
We could do a $500 million for internet. And
yes,
I suspect it might get as much support as the levy for improving the roads. I mean, we don't know. It hasn't really been strongly pursued. I mean, the bottom line is...
But why hasn't it been strongly pursued?
We could get public support for it.
Not public support. Why not?
I said that we probably could get
public could.
Support if we made a strong case for it.
Well, then why haven't we made a strong case for it?
Because
I'm trying to understand.
What happened is that folks who work for the city raise these large numbers, and it's almost a value system. Like, exactly, you have your finger on the point, is that people say, oh, it costs $400 million, and they haven't crossed the line from recognizing it's $400 million for a, shall we say, a luxury, as opposed to providing a necessity. And what they fall back on is, well, the private sector is doing it already, except they fail to recognize that the private sector is failing to provide it at affordable cost.
Okay, we have a panel here eager to weigh in. Erica C. Barnett.
Well, I agree that that broadband is a utility and should be regulated more like a utility. But when you're talking about up to, you know, the study actually said up to 600 million, not 400 million. You know, that's a lot of money. And blaming the mayor and saying that previous mayor Mike McGinn was going to do it is a little off the mark. Gigabit fell apart because it was a very poorly considered deal, and the company ended up, the company which was a startup and we would have been the guinea pigs, ended up, I believe, going under. And even with this $400 to $600 million investment, we would end up having to pay $75 a month. My bill to Comcast every month right now is about $85. So I would get better service, yes, because I hate my Comcast service, but I would still be paying about the same amount, and also the whatever I'd be paying in property taxes for that $600 million potential investment. So it doesn't seem like the greatest deal in the world to me when we're talking about the need for things like roads and people, you know, things that are basic human rights like mobility.
Aren't we there with the internet? Not only has it come to be the way we live, but it could take potentially people off the roads if they could do more in their homes than in the place where they have to drive to. Eli Sanders from The Stranger.
Well, I want to come back to something Nick said, which was this study is not going to be the final word. I don't understand why it wouldn't be. I wish it would be. It's the seventh study in 10 years that the city has done on this. It says that people want the internet to be faster and would support it being treated like a utility. I don't understand why politicians keep shuffling the onus for pushing this around. The public clearly wants it. And I want to ask Licata, do you think that the reason there's resistance to this from the executive branch is just simply that the mayor doesn't want anything to take away from the push for his transportation levy? He doesn't want, you know, broadband on the ballot, say, this fall, in a way that might make people pick that over transportation?
Well, the short answer is yes. And next year we have the housing levy, and we've gone to voters numerous times, and we have almost a schedule set up. We're going now just about every year for the huge levies. You know, the basic problem, I think, is that this has not taken a front row seat in the discussion. It's been on a sidebar discussion. And I will say, technology is rapidly changing. We all agree to that. And I think that's one of the problems it's not necessary. I don't mean to blame the mayors, but I think they've each tried their own way to do something. But you have to understand that this is a technical area that the technical engineers play a major role in influencing, I would say, the executive on what they decide to do. And giving an example, Erica touched on it. At $75 a month, it would work. If there's a $10 increase, then we have, according to the report, significant losses. We need what they call the measurement of takeaway of how many people who are eligible for it would actually take the service. In Chattanooga, it's 33%, and here we need 43%. You know, you end up with these very difficult, very complicated sort of engineering and marketing questions. But what Chattanooga did was they actually used their utility to go forward on it, and they were able to go into it in a way that they made a decision and they started moving to the area, and Comcast did not fight them.
Got government money, too. Nick Licata, yes. We have so many other things to talk about. Thank you for giving us the brief on this.
Sure.
Seattle City Council member Nick Licata on the technology committee. Bill Finkbeiner, haven't heard from you. You know, we've been asking. I wanted to know why is this not one of the things we subsidize? But you've told me, well, maybe it shouldn't be one of the things we subsidize. For one thing, anything the city would build might be a dinosaur.
Yeah, I think there's a real risk for that. I also think there might be a better way to do this. I mean, the cable companies and the phone companies are using the public right-of-way, which is really a public asset. And so in return for their monopoly, they sign a franchise agreement that comes to all sorts of agreements with the city, like you're going to give universal coverage and all this. And I tried to look at the franchise agreement, but it's 68 pages and it was kind of small type. But it seems like maybe you could throw that in there and say, okay, look, you have to start unbundling internet service and provide a baseline internet service that's maybe a bit more affordable, and push the risk off onto to the phone company, because really this looks to me like it's a business plan and it's got a lot of risk in it. You're saying, okay, $700 million investment. We think at this price point we'll get 43% of the people to take it up, but you don't have any idea. And if you miss, you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay, last word in one word or one sentence. Who thinks Comcast political contributions affect the debate?
I don't know how much, but it is worth pointing out that the mayor received contributions from Comcast in his current run for office.
Erica C.?
I think,
is for Comcast?
I think out of in a million-dollar race, so a few $700 contributions from Comcast does not make that big of a difference.
Former politician, Bill
Finkbeiner? If they didn't think it influenced to some degree, I don't think they'd make it.
KUOW is Week in Review, and we're going to be later this hour giving your advice to UW grads. If only you will go on Twitter, go to @KUOW and give us your Twitter-sized advice. That's all we need, a nutshell. What do you want to tell UW grads this weekend? More news discussion in a moment on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review, touching on the top stories of the past 7 days. This past weekend, Metro buses started playing new automated safety messages in English, Spanish, and Mandarin.
Please hold on.
Por favor, sosténgase.
请抓紧扶手.
The announcements played every time the bus left a stop.
For your safety, please stand behind the yellow line while the bus is in motion.
Passengers complained so much that Metro quickly pulled the announcements and apologized. But what made them so annoying? Was it the repetition?
Please hold on.
Por favor, sosténgase.
请抓紧扶手.
Please hold on.
Yes, riders disliked the repetition, but they particularly resented this announcement.
Metro coaches are equipped with audio and video surveillance cameras. Illegal activities are recorded and reviewed.
Illegal activities are being recorded? Some passengers thought that was Big Brother-ish. Others thought maybe their driver was playing it in response to something happening on their bus right then. Panel, how can Metro protect and inform their customers without driving them crazy, Bill Finkbeiner?
I don't know. I think we've sort of seen such a huge erosion of our civil liberties and loss of privacy that we just don't like to be reminded of it. You know, I was thinking that maybe they could have Eric Snowden sort of do the PSA and say, you know, every phone call you make is currently being collected by the government, you know, right before you make your call.
So you're saying we want our buses to have security cameras on them, but just don't tell us about it.
Don't remind us.
Erica C. Barnett?
Well, I think that these were especially annoying because people felt accused. I also think that, you know, it sends a message to both regular riders and tourists that buses are the place you come for to see illegal activity happening. But, you know,
isn't it reassuring to be told that it's all being recorded and reviewed?
Well, here's the thing. It isn't.
We got your back.
Here's the thing. It isn't. I mean, it is true that in some cases, if you see an illegal activity, you can tell Metro, hey, I saw this thing happen, and they will go and review that particular tape. But they don't review all the tape. So that is, the message itself is inaccurate. And a lot of buses don't have cameras. And the ones that do often have cameras that do not work. So I did a piece on this about a year ago, and many of the cameras at that time didn't do anything. So it if anything, it could create a false sense of security. But I also think that, you know, if you are on a bus, for example, that is empty, the messages about, you know, stand behind the yellow line, hang on, makes no sense. And I talked to someone who was on a bus that was virtually empty. It was this is a white person who was on the bus with a black person. The white person was sitting in the front, the black person was sitting in the back, and constantly on this long route, every 5 minutes or every time the door opened, you know, it would play this message about illegal activities are being recorded. And, you know, what would that feel
like? Who are they talking to?
Exactly.
Yeah, imagine you just walk on a bus. As soon as you walk on a bus, there's an announcement. illegal activities are being recorded.
We're watching
Was
you.
Was it something I wore, Eli Sanders?
Maybe it's the presumption of illegal activities. Maybe they could just edit that part out and maybe repeat it a little less. I don't fully understand this thing because I actually don't mind being informed when recording is going on. But I didn't sit on a bus ride while these were going on and listen. It sounds like the repetition is a little much every time the door opens and closes, plus every 5 minutes after that. That's too much. And then also, I wonder whether people just think of the bus as a space where, like, if they roll the dice in the right way or fortune is on their side that day and there's no commotion and no fight and no fuss about something, it's like a moment of peace between one destination and another. And they just want this voice to shut up and all the other voices to shut up so they can listen to a podcast or some music or something like that.
Right. This is why we don't carpool. We don't want to hear voices while we're commuting.
And the drivers apparently and understandably hated it because they have to listen to it all day long over and over and over. I mean, imagine an 8-hour shift of that.
Okay. Imagine your dream life after that.
Okay. So the Metro says that they're going to review the situation, so they may unveil some kind of new announcement, maybe bus driver at the bus driver's discretion. We don't know what they're going to come up with. But it sounds like from our panel, maybe a more helpful message would be all activities, illegal or not, are being recorded to no avail because we don't review them. How about that? Can we agree on that, that would be the perfect announcement?
If it plays only once every 2 hours, right, or at driver discretion.
Driver discretion is advised. KUOW's Week in Review, we're going to talk housing, affordable housing, who ought to pay for it, roads, crosswalks, bridges, $1 billion worth, who ought to pay for it, and graduates, here's the one thing you need to know. Stay tuned. Catching you up in just one short hour on the big news of the week. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. The city of Seattle wants to be a place where unrich people can afford to live. This week, city officials have been asking who should provide affordable housing. It ain't the free market because rents and home prices keep rising. From the stranger, Eli Sanders, who should pay for affordable housing?
Well, this is the big debate right now, and I've heard so many different proposals and then criticisms of those proposals. It doesn't sound like to me there's a perfect solution, but at the moment, the best solution, as far as I've understood it, sounds like actually the city getting into the game of building more public subsidized housing. The free market is not going to get us what we need in terms of new housing to drive down rents, and so there's this push to have the city issue bonds to buy up either vacant lots or old buildings that are being sold and snatch them up before a developer does, and then build affordable housing that you can get into if you're making median income or less.
Sort of like we said with broadband, city, you want affordable housing, build affordable housing. Erica Barnett, why not?
Well, actually, I agree that the city should get more in the business of providing affordable housing itself, but I think they should do that through the housing levy, not through a bond. The problem with a bond is that ordinarily we use bonds for things that are sort of one time, like the seawall. And housing is an ongoing forever problem. So let's say we take out $1 billion in bonds to buy up a bunch of housing, you know, our land to build housing. There's no way we could spend $1 billion on housing in 5 years even. So it's an impractical tool that will have us taking out a lot of debt and having money sitting around because we can't literally put that money on the ground as quickly as we would have it. So an ongoing levy just makes a lot more sense. The big idea right now, of course, and I don't know if we're going to get to this in detail, but is the linkage fee.
Let's talk about that in a moment. First, you're right. So two out of two, bond or levy, city, just build affordable housing and make it affordable. Bill Finkbeiner, agreed?
I think, you know, it's great for the city to build affordable housing. People want to tax themselves to do that. But the reality is, you know, I think, is that you're never going to be able to build enough housing to basically make it affordable for everybody who's, you know, I think the example they used in their study was everybody who's living on a beginning teacher's salary. You know, for a family living on a beginning teacher's salary, the city is not going to be able, and especially if they turn around and charge people who are building and add expenses to that, I don't see how you're going to, you know, how you're going to do it. So basically it becomes sort of a lottery. It's like, did you win the lottery and did you get into that highly subsidized house? And
what's wrong with that?
Well, if you did, great. I mean, more power to you. But there's going to be a lot of other people. It's going to be a smaller percent. It's going to be a small percentage of people who need affordable housing. I think the really the only solution, and it's tough because we're probably never going to catch up to demand. But the only solution is to increase supply by changing zoning. And you know, Seattle started with that, and it's hard because you change neighborhoods. But it's also, you know, pretty.
So you're
much,
saying more multifamily development. Allowed.
You have to. It's also, you know, we started on this path 20 years ago when we passed Growth Management Act in this state, and that was the whole idea. We were seeing people moving further out and more sprawl, and people moving away from the infrastructure. And we said, it's time to move people back into where the infrastructure is, and build dense cities instead of broad suburbs. And so dense cities mean that you're going to have more growth. And especially when Seattle's booming like it is now, there's just going to be more demand for housing, definitely than the city's ever going to keep up with. And probably realistically, you know, you don't want to get rid of, you know, zoning laws. We don't want to have a massive change too fast. But I think we're going to have to expect that Seattle's going to change if we're going to keep it reasonably, you know, anything close to affordable. Otherwise, it's going to look like San Francisco. You cut off the supply and the prices just explode.
Eli Sanders, more apartments and condos.
Yeah. And I think Bill is right to point out the zoning issue. I was talking to Josh Veit yesterday, who brought up over and over again a point that many of us forget. 65% of the city is zoned single family residence. So when you have a situation like that, where are you going to put this density? And if you want to dial back the percentage of single family homes, you are going to run into huge resistance from homeowners.
Can you hear the heads of single family homeowners exploding right now at what you guys are saying?
Well, no, because I think they are very confident that things are not going to change in a direction that doesn't favor them. They have a lot of influence on the city council.
Mm-hmm. And they're complaining a lot already about the idea of, I mean, just the most minor, tiny, you know, concessions to multifamily housing, not even in single family zones, but in single family adjacent zones. I want to go back to the linkage fee.
Yes.
I wrote a story yesterday on the csforcrank.com that about the new proposal out of the city that would allow a linkage fee of up to $28 a square foot, which is a tremendous amount.
This means
money.
Making developers pay a fee or a tax.
It's a tax on development, essentially, yes. Per square foot, and it would vary throughout the city. It's got a ton of support. It's probably going to pass in some form. The linkage fee would also potentially apply to single-family homes, which has never been really discussed before. And that, of course, is likely to terrify single-family home developers, but it's an, you know, it's not, I don't think, you know, I agree with Eli. I think the linkage fee is not a great solution, and this also goes to what Bill is saying, because it does discourage development. It makes development more expensive, and then what development does get built is going to be more expensive for renters. So I agree that getting changing some of our zoning laws so that we actually welcome people here as opposed to protecting single family zones as absolutely sacrosanct in every instance is what we're going to have to do.
Would any of the three of you stand to lose your single family home if what you're saying became policy?
I don't live in a single. I rent an apartment.
Right.
So no.
I rent an apartment too, but I don't think anybody stands to lose their single family home with a change in policy unless they decide to sell it to a developer.
Yeah. It's more like what you're living next door to.
Right.
Right. And I hear you saying that even then, even if we gave the free market more rein, we're still not going to be an affordable city. Bill, is that what you're basically saying?
I mean, it's all relative, you know, compared to a lot of other big cities where actually, you know, our housing is a little more affordable
right.
compared to the average wage. But, you know, as a living wage, realistically, to be able to afford a house, it's already unaffordable and probably in the near term going to get more unaffordable. But, you know, the housing market has ups and downs. And, you know, it'll probably have a down market again, and then hopefully it'll be more affordable. But the only way, you know, to make it the best way, I think, to address it is to just get more dense.
We're talking about how to pay for affordable housing, more dense, more apartment, more condos, linkage fees. And we talked about just the city building low-income housing. And, you know, I saw in the Seattle Times that Redfin, the online real estate brokerage, reports that Seattle is the number one destination for people coming from the Bay Area. So because we're cheaper, significantly cheaper than the Bay Area. So right now there's a show on a San Francisco public radio station that this second is having its Week in Review program, and they're asking who should pay for affordable housing. Well, there's your answer. We'll pay for it. Go move to Seattle. This is KOW's Week in Review, back with Who Pays for Roads and Who Tells What to Graduates this weekend, coming up. We're smartening you up about the top stories of the week on The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, Seattle debated the largest levy proposal in its history. The mayor wants to ask voters for $930 million for maintaining and improving streets, bridges, and sidewalks. The debate this week was about who would pay. Erica C. Barnett, who should pay $1 billion for paving and bike lanes and overpasses and crosswalks and stuff?
Well, a little bit of context here. The proposal is a property tax, and there's been a separate proposal from Councilmember Nick Licata, who's just on, to reduce the total amount of levy to $830 million and to require that some of it come to about $300 million, I think, $200 million. You know, when you're talking hundreds of millions, who cares?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, can we start with property tax? Because
yeah,
this
sure,
would be
sure.
Seattle only. Property owners, why should Seattle property owners pay for roads that are used by people who commute in from outside the city?
Well, most of the levy is for basic road maintenance, so things like local bridges and local potholes and things like that. I suppose you could make an argument that we should put this on the ballot region-wide, but A, it wouldn't pass. And B, these are roads and projects that are mostly going to be used by Seattle. It's similar to the old Bridging the Gap levy from 2006. It's, you know, let's fix the stuff that's wrong, you know, before or in addition to building new projects. So it's not the sexiest levy, but it's also one that, you know, will have the most impact and benefit to people in Seattle.
Okay, so you're okay with the Seattle property tax?
I am okay with the Seattle property tax because I think it's the best way that we have to pay for these projects. The other proposals have various problems, one of them being that they would use up most of the capacity for the alternative taxes like the parking tax and the employee hours tax. And I don't see any reason that we should gobble up all of our parking tax capacity and all of our quote unquote head tax capacity for Move Seattle.
That's anti-gobbling activist Erica C. Barnett. Eli Sanders from The Stranger, any thoughts? Who ought to pay?
Well, I'm fine with property owners paying since I live in an apartment. But I'm actually...
They're going to jack your rent,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm being a little facetious there because I know that the costs get passed on to renters if you start to raise property taxes too much on property owners. So I don't know. My head is kind of swimming with all of these proposals right now. And Licata's counter proposal to the mayor's proposal, as I understand it, is an attempt to make this more... progressive. He thinks that the combination of taxes that's being proposed by the mayor is regressive, And I have tried to get my head around this and failed. And I actually like appeal to Erica for help, please, on like how, what is the progressive regressive split on these taxes that are being talked about? And what is Licata saying?
Well, I think that the argument for a parking tax is that it's a tax on people who drive their cars to work primarily. And, you know, and that we don't want to encourage people to drive. And so that's progressive in that sense.
Environmentally progressive?
But,
in that sense?
Well, in that, yeah. And
congestionally progressive.
Sure. But, you know, but and I think the argument against property taxes is that a lot of people have owned their homes for a long time and they've appreciated so much that they're paying an unfair property tax level now. But
oh, boo-hoo. Their home is worth so much now.
But the thing, just real quickly, the thing about the employee hours tax that's actually that actually works against that second definition of progressive is that Licata's proposal, unlike the proposal under the previous mayor, would not include any exemption for people who take the bus to work. So before, they would get employers would get a huge exemption from this tax for employees who did not drive into work. So it encouraged things like free transit passes and other incentives for people to not drive alone.
Well, buses use up the roads, too. Tear them up, clog them up.
Well, I wouldn't say that they clog them up, since a bus can carry significantly more people than, you know, the number of cars who would take up the same amount of space.
Bicyclist Eli Sanders.
Well, I just want to, another way to look at just the parking tax for an example of, you know, how you can see these things as progressive and regressive at the same time. Since the parking tax is applied evenly, no matter what kind of car you can afford, say, it's actually regressive in the same way that the sales tax is, that you pay the same amount of sales tax, whether you're Bill Gates or Erica C. Barnett and Eli Sanders.
Bill Finkbeiner, yeah, a former Republican State Senate Majority Leader, what say you?
So I'm the wrong person to ask on sort of progressive dogma to define what's what, but
you're okay with regressive taxes?
No. Well, no, I think we should try to have progressive taxes where we can. I just couldn't understand at all how he is saying that a parking tax or a headcount tax would be more progressive than a property tax. Property tax feels to me like it's the closest thing we have to a wealth tax. We have no other place in this state where we actually tax wealth. And really, the value of your home for most people is where most of their wealth is. And I think you're exactly right, too. And you say, you know, it's hard when you're a politician because you have a lot of people complaining about their property taxes going up. But I always felt the same way, which is if your property taxes went up, you know, so much, well, that means your house is worth a lot more than what you paid for it. And that's basically money in the bank. And it's, you know, it's hard when that happens. And I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of tough stories about people getting taxed out of their house. But at the same time, there's a lot of tough stories about people who can't afford to buy a house. So I think if you're going to tax something, I think property taxes is a really progressive tax. And when you start, the other thing about parking tax is that I feel like the worst thing about the parking tax is the fines that build up. There's a lot of people that I've seen that have had their credit just wrecked by not paying a parking ticket or two. And it's, you know, it adds up really fast, and then it's going to collection. And it really hits a lot of people hard, and a lot of people who can least afford it, and you know, compared to property tax.
Just to be clear, really quick, the commercial parking tax would be on commercial parking, not on meter parking. So it's not parking tickets. So just wanted to clarify that.
But now I want to clarify something else. Isn't it in commercial parking lots, though?
Yeah.
So if you pull into the lot and you stay longer, you'll get a ticket for overstaying or something like that. It's not the city giving you ticket and levying fines, but they'll send you to court if you don't pay your ticket.
Or they tow your car and now you got a $250 impound fee. And
okay, so $1 billion levy or so, something like that. Bill and Erica are okay with the property tax. Eli, your head was hurting. Have we helped?
Only a little bit. And I want to say the reason that my head is swimming with parking tax, head tax, property tax, and which combination of them is the most progressive, the reason I have to have that headache, and I know I'll be accused of returning to old topics on this, but the reason I have that headache is because we don't have the root of an income tax available.
Ah, the income tax.
And Bill, and we have, actually, our Republican friend here, was effectively pointing that out by saying that we don't have a good wealth tax in this state, and so we have to turn to the property tax. Well, an income tax in a city with such stratified income right now and so much angst connected to that could be actually a very fair way of directing in a progressive manner available money to roads and transit.
To those playing the drinking game at home, we did just say income tax, so consume, and we hope your head is feeling better now as we take that drink, Eli.
That's my public service.
We're going to be right back with doing the grads a public service of telling them what they should know as they have their commencement address. Stay tuned. In fact, let's bring in KUOW's social media producer, Sarah Richards. Sarah, I asked listeners to give advice to grads on Twitter at KUOW. What's worth sharing?
Sure. We got some really good responses. Meg says, your passions and your career don't have to be the same for you to be content. Don't sacrifice the good in pursuit of the perfect.
So, in other words, go get a job that you don't love, but at least it's a job? Right? It doesn't have to be your passion. It's just a career. Do you have your passion outside your career? Okay, one more before, and we'll come back to more.
Sure. Will says, life advice, save 10% of your income in retirement now before you miss it.
Ah, what income? You're a grad.
Yeah.
Thank you, Will. And more of your comments in a moment. Have you thought about this? By the way, I bring it up because, it's obviously a graduation season. We've got the commencement addresses are coming in, right? It's the time of year when you say, who hit it out of the park? Filmmaker John Waters. Do you everybody know John Waters? Pink Flamingos and Mondo Trasho and Hairspray. He admits freely he is famous for his shockingly bad taste. He told graduates of the Rhode Island School of Design, keep being shocking.
Go out in the world and f*** it up beautifully. Design clothes so hideous that they can't be worn ironically. Horrify us with new ideas. Outrage outdated critics. Use technology for transgression, not lazy social living. Make me nervous. And finally, count your blessings. You got through college. You didn't commit suicide, OD, or have a nervous breakdown. And let's remember the ones who did. It's time to get busy. It's your turn to cause trouble. But this time in the real world. And this time from the inside. Thank you very much.
Your turn to cause trouble, graduates. That's John Waters. Tomorrow's commencement speaker for the UW is former Washington Governor Christine Gregoire. But if the speaker were Pulitzer Prize-winning Stranger editor Eli Sanders, what would be your main advice to graduates?
And if I was told I had to boil it down to just a few words,
right.
I was, those words would be, come out. If you're not out of the closet by the time you've graduated from college, you have missed the opportunity to get to know intimately people who are at the most beautiful part of their lives. It's all downhill from there. So come out while people are still looking hot.
In 2015, what's the percentage of gay graduates who aren't coming out?
I'm not sure. And it's even more of a waste in that context if you're not. And I was kind of floating this idea with my boyfriend last night of what I was going to say. And he said, well, tell people that it's not just for gay people who are in the closet. Like, if you are hiding some part of you, come out. Stop wasting time.
Come out. Erica C. Barnett.
Well, I would love to give advice to people who are entering college, which is don't blow off your opportunities to meet people that you will be able to network with later. But that also applies to after college.
So you want to give a commencement speech at the actual commencement of college, not at the end.
I strongly believe that should be done. But I think that applies after college, too. You have to get mentors, particularly, and this is something Bruce Harrell, the city council, actually says a lot, particularly if you're a member of a disadvantaged community, if you are African-American, if you are LGBT, if you are poor. You need to find successful mentors in your own community and in other communities and use the people that you know. That's what they're there for.
Use the people you know.
People who have accomplished a lot you know, get to know them, get to know how you can help them, and use their experience.
Bill Finkbeiner.
I've been racking my brain on this one since you told us this was going to be a topic, and actually since last week because my son graduated from high school. So I've been trying to think, like, what advice, and really having a hard time with it. But
well, what did you say when you put your arm around your son's shoulder?
Good job.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Yeah. Well done. You made it. Good job. But then I heard what, you know, probably my favorite quote of the last few weeks from the grannies who got arrested at the Shell Oil. 60s to 70s is the prime of your life. So, you know, take some pressure off for the next 30 years. You got something to look forward to there.
Call back to earlier in the show. You don't have to do it all in the next 4 weeks of your life. Sarah Richards, our social media producer. Any more KOW listener advice to grads?
Yeah, we've got two. Pursue your passions before you forget what they are.
Mm.
And we're all a lost generation anyway, grads. Debt, jobs, low wages, climate change. Eat, drink, and be merry and hope for a Mad Max ending.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm going. I would say life is meaningless, utterly meaningless, because kids want to know the meaning of life. But then when they think they have the right meaning, then they have to fight with the people who they think have the wrong meaning. And the reason you can't agree on the meaning is that there is no meaning. So you go make your own meaning, knowing that it's not the meaning. It's just your meaning. And Eli's shaking his head.
That's
I've lost my audience.
Advice. That's terrible advice.
What are you, Camus?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I am the myth of Sisyphus would be my, I would read the following pages.
That's terrible advice. They shouldn't think that they're absolutely right in their meaning. Other people can find their own meanings, but yeah, they should find a sense of purpose and push forward with it.
Okay, maybe a commencement debate with Eli Sanders and Bill Radke and Erica C. Barnett and Bill Finkbeiner. Thank you, Sarah Richards. KOW's Week in Review, produced by Jason Pagano. Next week, we're at the Northwest African American Museum, and we hope to see you there. So come see us. Thanks, everybody.